Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since October the 7th, 30,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. And this week, 3 Brits died in an Israeli airstrike. Westminster has been engulfed by calls to halt arms export licenses to Israel. Bassem Youssef is known to Egyptians as an exiled late-night comedy host, and to Americans as the Egyptian Jon Stewart. But most Brits know him from his interviews with Piers Morgan in the wake of October 7th. In this interview with Ollie, Bassem explains why there's not two sides in the Israel-Gaza war, Western hypocrisy, and why the UK and US are terrified of Netanyahu.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one!
It's the Politics Show. Cast.
I thought this was Joe Rogan. I don't know. I was
cheated. I'm sorry to disappoint.
They told me they're going to be on podcast with Joe. It's like, Joe Rogan. It's he's just Bridge Duke.
Start with Politics Show. I'm not as yoked as Joe Rogan as well. Unfortunately. I have got a full head of hair. Take that.
I hope it works for you.
I also have less problematic political opinions. Yeah, just about. Not quite. I haven't got the $100 million Spotify deal just yet. I mean, if anyone's out there considering it, I mean, we will take it.
He has a full set of hair after all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. how are you, Bassem? You okay?
I'm great.
Good. Very glad to have you here. For those not familiar with your work, why don't you tell us who you are, what you do? How would you like to introduce yourself?
Very quickly, I used to be a heart surgeon.
Yeah.
All my life.
You
7 years
in
medical
first.
School, yes. I have to brag about that.
Yeah, rightly so.
I have to brag. I used to be a heart surgeon. I used to be a heart surgeon.
Yeah.
And then after 19 years of medical school and working as a surgeon, I left all of that during the wake of the Arab Spring. I had my own show, a political satire show, kind of like the Egyptian version of the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I was in Egypt for 3.5 years. I had 3 seasons. Got into trouble because of my show. Was arrested, interrogated, had to leave. The military, the Islamists hated me both. So that means I'm doing something right. And then I had to escape. Went to America. And 5 years ago, I started a new career at the age of 45, doing stand-up comedy in my second language in English. And now I am having a European tour in English, starting with London, April 6th, doing 16 cities, 25 shows in 30 days.
It's impressive, man.
I mean, that's a good intro.
Yeah, it is a good intro.
We're done. We're good.
Yeah, so well,
you're
finished.
Thank you very much.
You've plugged the tour, so we can finish
now. Thank you so much.
Draw a line under it. So, I mean, we'll talk about comedy. I particularly actually want to talk about comedy in the context as well of kind of the politics of what's happening at the moment. But just a word on performing in a second language.
At the beginning, it was very daunting. Still today,
because
at the end of the day, you don't have that kind of foundation all of your life with that language. So you're not a master of the language. You think you are, but at least you try to act as if you are. But deep inside, you know that it's not your language. And me coming from the background of being a doctor, being a nerd, there's a lot of studying, a lot of imitating, a lot of rehearsing, a lot of pretending to look like as if I know what I'm doing. And also comedy in a second language is very interesting because each language has its own rhythm, own music, own sense of delivery.
Mm.
So, and this is something you cannot teach. You just have to acquire it. And I had to do that very quickly in order to, because I was already starting late. So I didn't have the luxury of time and doing it for years and years and years and practicing with it. So yeah, it's quite a task.
I mean, even between Americans and British people, right? The sense of humor is completely different. The cultural touchstone is completely different.
Absolutely.
The nature of the comedy is completely different, right?
So imagine I'm doing a stand-up comedy with my second language in English while actually being in America and then getting that set up with in Europe, talking to a people that might not even be British, but might be British from other origins. So you see how everything is not...
Yeah, it's all set up against you almost to fail. I'm sure you're not going to, but it's intense.
Yes, it's very intense. I'm doing a comedy in a language that's not mine, but a second language, American style, in England, and many of the people who come to my show are not from British origin, but from somewhere else in the world. It is, and not just, I mean, England is actually the easiest part, because at least they speak English.
Mm.
But if you're going to people, and many of the people who come to my shows are immigrants, imagine going to Sweden.
Yeah.
Or to Denmark, or to Germany. English there is a third language. So that is that's quite challenging.
Have you tried to scan it back the other way yet and do comedy? Because I imagine even if you were trying to, the jokes, you couldn't just translate them, right? The sense of humor would be completely different, right?
No, you're right in English. I started doing an Arab stand-up comedy a year ago after the English. And I tell you what, the English is much more easier for me.
Stop it.
Yeah.
Really?
Because when you speak to... But when you do, English is a unifying language, believe it or not. It's a universal language. When you talk about the immigrant experience, people that come to the show, they can relate to you. In Arabic, I'm speaking to people from Arabic background. You just talked about like the British humor and the American humor. No, let's talk about the Moroccan dialect and the Saudi dialect or the Egyptian dialect that has nothing to do with it. It's totally different. So you're going out and even the tool of communication, which is the language, is quite variable. I'm not talking about the difference between a New York accent and an Alabama accent. I'm talking about like the difference between someone who's living in Oklahoma and someone who's living in the deep parts of Scotland or Wales.
Totally
different. That is how variable and how... diverse the Arab dialects are.
It's not just a case of accent, it's vocabulary, it's almost...
references, experiences, all of that has to be taken into account. So Arabic is actually much more difficult for me.
Mm, okay. Well, we're going to talk about the role of comedy, I think, and particularly actually as well, the role of comedy within politics over the course of this interview. One of the things that I'll be honest, the sort of, I think for a lot of British people, you sort of first came onto their radar culturally as a result of an interview you did with Piers Morgan, right?
Yes.
In the wake of October 7th.
Yeah.
So can you talk to me about why you wanted to do that interview? I mean, it was sort of, like I said, 10 days after October 7th happens. Was it to do with sort of media narratives, presenting a counter sort of viewpoint? Why was it that you wanted to go and speak to Piers?
Well, I didn't want to.
Mm.
I was actually offered to come on to Piers Morgan's show 5 days before, and I said no twice. And for the third time, I said yes. And then they canceled on me quite a couple of times because they were having other people going.
Revenge.
But it actually, I should have been on that show a week before. And I couldn't because I didn't know what to say because the media narrative was set up in a way that like you're going to be burned if you come and talk about anything other than the Israeli point of view.
Mm.
But then 10 days in, I saw the narrative and I saw that like the lies were so obvious. And being like looking at things from the outside, it's like something was not checking out. Something is not working. And you know, the little bit of research and I see the lies and the stuff that they were using in order to justify killing so many people was just crazy. Like, oh, Israel is the only military in the world that warns civilians before they bomb us. Like, what kind of excuse is that?
Mm.
You know, the same thing that they say about the Israeli army, the Israeli army is the most moral army in the world because they are a vegan army. Which is, and it's like you can write a whole like routine about that.
Yeah, because, you could.
They use biodegradable bullets. Reusable body bags.
Yeah, nice.
You know,
sustainable.
Sustainable missiles. You know, it's like, why we should celebrate that. Yeah, go Israel. It's just, what the hell is this? Why did this is farce? This is farce. And just like people are like the people on the Western media platform are like nodding, yes, yes, yes. But then they bring in like an Arab, do you condemn Hamas? Are you serious? It's just like, and I saw all of this and I said like, wait a minute. You're just talking about like the killing of Gaza and that's normal. What about the West Bank where there's no Hamas? And I talk about this in many interviews. I talk about the banality of evil, how people are just accepting so many things. Take it as normal. I mean, I when I was on that interview, like with Piers Morgan, we didn't even hit the 3,000 death mark at the time. Now we're 33,000. We're just people have been so desensitized. And they're like, when I was there, we're talking about who bombed the Al Ahli hospital. Is it Israel or is this a misfire by a Hamas rocket? Since then, Israel bombed 36 hospitals and there is nothing. Mm-hmm. It is like fine. And because there's always a justification, there is a Hamas base underneath the hospital. Do you have a proof? Yes, here's a CGI video. That's it. And we have to take Israel account for anything, but we don't speak. It's just the fact that the Western media that has lectured us for years about transparency and journalistic integrity, they're just like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we're going to act stupid and let it go. It's just like very stupid. So maybe even within the first 10 days, it was enough for me to say, wait a minute, that's stupid. This is very stupid. How are you people like accepting that? So I just went there. I said, like, how many people should we kill? As many as you can. I went on with everything that they said, and it just, people say, wait a minute, that's stupid. How are you accepting this?
The thing that's very striking for me at the moment is the fact that international journalists are not allowed into Gaza right now, which is, you know, a revealing fact, right? If you don't want...
It's been for that for 6 months, and even the only one who's there, who's Al Jazeera, has been labeled by Israel as a terrorist organization, and we have, okay, yes, master, yes, of course, yes, whatever you say.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, that's so stupid. Why is the Muslim media so emasculated when it comes to Israel?
Yeah.
Why do they do, where do their balls go? Where they're like, they're all, like their fiery opening statements about Russia and Ukraine, but when it comes to Israel, oh no, so it's okay, of course, yes, they're terrorists, they're collateral damage.
It was really interesting to me for two reasons, right? The first, because I think I saw you talking about this another time, and you sort of said that really the talking points you went on there, you didn't even think that you were sort of did like an incredible performance, right? That the talking points, the things you were talking about, actually were the things that a lot of people say to each other, right? But it's just not represented in the Western media. Yeah, so no. you didn't feel like it was like some crazy thing that you'd done. And then obviously it does like 22 million views or whatever. But that contrast with Ukraine, I think, is revealing, right? Because I think either our morality is universal and you can take issue with military aggression, regardless of who the victims of it are, or your morality isn't universal.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the quiet part that should be said out loud is that people don't care about Palestinians and they look at them as lesser human beings. Forget Gaza, forget Hamas, forget the proportionate response. In the West Bank, since 7th of October, 495 people were killed, 100 of them were children in the West Bank. And that is normal because we have been so desensitized by the 33,000 people. Who cares about 100 people dead? See how the banality of evil, how people just get used to it. And it becomes like a regular thing. People talk about, but it's the hostage. There are what, 70 hostages, 30 hostages?
130, what? I think.
130 now. Hostages? Yeah. Well, in Israeli prisons, there are 5,000 Palestinians. Half of them are not even accused of anything. That's 5,000 hostages. 5,000. But it's okay. It's normal. People just accept it and go on. Nobody talks about them because these are hostages. When you go in and you kidnap people from other people's homes and you put it in your prisons, that's not a prisoner. That's a hostage. When you displace like more than 1,200 people from their homes on daily basis, that is not normal. But yet people just accept it and forget about it. The fact that Palestinian farmers cannot actually get any part of the land for agriculture outside of Area C, which is the most fertile part of the West Bank. And Palestinians cannot have a land there. Can you imagine? They have to go on. And you know, you can't even dig for wells. For you can't dig for us in the West Bank. I'm talking about Gaza because Gaza is evil. It's Hamas, you know. But like there, like in the West Bank, you can't even dig a well. You can't even increase the depth of your well. An Israeli settler have five times the amount of water per capita than in a Palestinian. And people just have to live with that. It's like, yeah, it's normal. It's okay. It's just like it's the normalcy and the people just getting desensitized for things. Like if 100 children died in 6 months anywhere in the world, people will be like up in arms. Mm. But the Palestinians, it doesn't matter because they are animals. So if you treat people like animals, I say this everywhere, if you treat people like animals and they revolt against you like animals, why are you surprised?
Mm. What do you think is behind that dehumanization? The word you used was desensitization, right?
Yeah.
Do you think it's something deliberate, whether that's via the media, via propaganda? Do you think
I don't know, but it's there. I don't know if it's designed, because like when you go, it's by design. So suddenly people, I'm going to be put in the category of a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, I don't mean like that.
But
I mean,
but I don't know what it is. But like the atrocities that have happened to Palestinians for years had just like been like swept under the rug and nobody cares. And then when there's like a more than heavier than usual attack, suddenly the West media, oh no, Israel, that's too much. Come on. It's like, but they were terrorists. There were people in the hospital and we had to go in and kill them. Oh, okay, 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 all right. You know, like, remember, I mean, you have to remember this scene when like Israeli forces like were dressed as doctors and nurses and went into a hospital in the West Bank and killed three people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why? It's like, because there are terrorists. Yeah, okay, okay. And you know, like this is an example how Israel defines terrorism. 2010. There's a woman named Suad Zoykot and her husband were killed. And then a few years later, she published a Facebook post that's like, may God unite us in heaven. And because of that post, she was accused of being a terrorist and she was put under detention in a prison for 8 months. This is how they define who's a terrorist. You know, they kill UN workers. Today, seven people died from the International Center kitchen. First, okay, it's Hamas. And it's like, oh, it's us, but oops, mistakes happen. Well, it's us, what can you do? Collateral damage. You see, so it doesn't, the whole idea that they waste so much time trying to waste this time in this like mental exercises that doesn't need anywhere. And even when they say, okay, you killed them. Yeah, but don't Israel have the right to defend itself? You see how this circular, the conversation gets? You don't get anywhere with them.
But there's no historical context, right? Because I feel like there's essentially a system of provocation, 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 until eventually the point you made, right, which is that essentially you get a reaction, either from Hamas or from other groups, whoever it is.
Yeah.
And as a result of which, when we discuss and talk about, the most recent example is just, well, what about October 7th, right? But that kind of unitary approach to the history of it, you denude it of the context of decades of whether it's oppression, violence, terrorism from both sides enacting it on each other.
No, don't say from both sides.
Okay.
Because this is unfair. You cannot compare an arsenal that is armed to the teeth. You know, it's a nuclear power, and you just like a few militants. You cannot just it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Especially like, here's the thing. Israel wants you to think that everything started on October 7th. As if there was a ceasefire on October 6th. Actually, 2 weeks before October 7th, Israel did like three airstrikes in Gaza, just regular, normal. And before October 7th, there were 234 Palestinians were killed, 76 of them with children in the West Bank.
Mm.
That's normal. The idea of like, they keep pushing you and pushing you and pushing you. So if you throw rocks, they break your limbs. If you take up armed resistance, you're a terrorist. If you sit put in your home, they will come in and use settlers to kick you out, like Sheikh Jarrah. They will take your home and your land away. So there's no point of you doing anything. If you are not even living in Palestine and you choose to boycott Israeli goods, you are not going to be able to work with 37 federal states governments, because they have rules against BDS, which is weird that like South Dakota have to have a rule to defend Israel commerce. It is just doesn't make any sense anymore. It just doesn't make any sense. And I don't know the whole idea about like trying to make like, oh, but they did this and they did this. No, this is all a reaction. They keep pushing you. As a matter of fact, I don't even know how come the 7 million Palestinians who live inside Israel have not all joined Hamas. There is a very famous interview by Ehud Barak in 2014 when Gideon Levy, he's a reporter in Hearts, he asked him, if you were born Palestinian, what would you do? You know what Ehud Barak says? Like, I would join a terrorist group to fight for my country. And you have all of this in front of them, and all that about Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. You have like Netanyahu admitting on tape that he was supporting Hamas, and he was like letting money flow to them. It is right in front of you, and they have the audacity to deny it. And so, like, they look at your face like, I don't care.
When I say both sides, I'm not drawing an equivalence between the actions from either side. I think it's clearly the power of dynamic is asymmetrical, right? You know, you have on the one hand an occupied people, and on the other you have one of the most high-grade militaries of anywhere in the world. Mm. What
and
I mean
it's the
to
longest
say,
occupation in the modern history.
What I mean to say when I say both sides is that violence is exchanged. Yes, the scale of it is different, but there is certainly still violence that heads from the Palestinian direction towards the Israeli one. That's what I was referring to when I said both sides.
I mean, if you put me like against the wall, what do you expect me to do? Mm. I mean, you're killing me behind your walls. You're killing me with your drones behind your screens. You're sitting comfortably. You use me as a video games, you know, an X, a square, and a circle, boom. And then you're just like happy that I am in my confined, behind confined walls. And then at a certain point when the walls are breached, you are going to get face to face with what you have created. Right? Because it's so easy. It's like, a Palestinian's taking a knife and going and kill you, well, that's terrorism. But if I fly and then $64 million F-16 and I boom and like a missile and kill it, like annihilating a whole square, a whole like block, that's not terrorism, that's war. I just boom. Because there's comfort in being remotely removed of killing of all of these people. So you're just like sitting there in your comfortable spaces and pushing buttons and killing of all of these people, and when somebody comes in and pushes a bullet back, it's like, oh, terrorism.
Do you think terrorism is a useful term?
I don't know what you call it. I mean, here's the thing. We waste our time in defining things. I was in France 24 the other day, and they were asking me, what do you think? Is this what Israel is like doing is genocide? Because there was no genocide in front of October 6th. Like, what? Who cares? Really, who cares? Who cares about the definition of genocide? And I'd say, it's like, how about like other words, like too much killing? A lot of murders. Extreme termination of life.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Is that better? That does the word genocide bother you that bad?
Uh-huh.
And then you know what? After you go in and you prove it's genocide. Well, so what? Israel has the right to defend itself. It's not ending. The thing is, you think you're going to win a conversation or an argument, it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, it's all a waste of time in order to do that. Remember how, like, for 2 months they were asking, what's a proportionate response, which is the most stupid question ever.
Mm.
Does Israel have the right to defend itself? Well, you know what? I think that Israel has the right to go fuck itself. Seriously. I mean, because this is, like, fucked up.
Mm. So when I ask that question, I'm not sort of trying to get into abstract linguistic conversations. I think it's useful because it demonstrates that quite often we just use terrorist as an insult, right? We use it as a pejorative term to describe our enemies, rather than, because the point you made, right, what is the difference? If you drop a bomb on a school from a plane, you kill innocent people, and the difference between someone who walks into a building with a bomb strapped to them and blows it up and kills innocent people, is there a material difference between those two things?
Yeah, because one of them is done by the chosen people. We are the chosen people. We are the chosen people. God chose us. And you know what really pisses me off about the Christians who repeat that bullshit? They are the chosen people. And I say, like, if you think they're the chosen people, why don't you join them? Why don't you join? Why don't you become Jewish? Mm. I mean, it's like, wouldn't you feel unchosen? Wouldn't you feel left out? They're the chosen people. Join them. And this, the same Christians don't see what they do in Christians when they go to Jerusalem. They get spit on, kicked by Jewish people who actually despises Christians. This whole bullshit about, like, Christians, Judeo-Christian values. There's nothing called Judeo-Christian. This actually was adapted in the 20th century. It was not meant to be made by the founding fathers or anything. That was like made up very recently. And it was not part of American history, and it was just like increased after the Holocaust. But it wasn't really part of our American culture. And the fact that they openly despise Christians, and they openly make fun of Christ, and make, you have videos of rabbis talking about the Virgin Mary as a whore who have actually slept with someone else, and she made this whole idea about like the Son of God so she wouldn't be stoned or killed. by the Jewish people. They talk about that openly.
Mm.
But then a lot of Christians go in and talk about Islam and how of a harmful religion we are. And they don't. They really ignore what the Jews, what the extreme Jewish people in Israel say about them. Maybe the one thing, the silver lining of all of this, like maybe now people are talking about this.
Does it not fall foul of the same problem though, right? That in the same way that in the West, we kind of, particularly in the media and absolutely our politicians actually, they try to characterize Islam as being defined by its most extreme proponents, mm-hmm. its fundamentalists, which I think is wrong, right? Like I dispute that to the strongest level. Similarly, to argue that extreme rabbis, the most, I don't know, extreme Orthodox individuals, their version of Judaism is not the Judaism of, for example, sort of Western liberal Jews. And I don't know if it's fair to sort of characterize that entire faith based on...
Absolutely, I agree with you. But isn't it weird that the same extreme rabbis are the head rabbis of the Israeli army? Isn't it like weird that like their words is being repeated by the prime minister themselves? When the prime minister talk about the Amalek. When you talk about the Amalek, basically you're giving permission to kill everybody, woman or child or anything, because they're the Amalek, they need to be wiped out.
Yeah.
So it's the same way, like you cannot judge the Arab world or the Muslim world by some extreme rhetoric said by the leaders of ISIS, right? But if the president of Egypt or the king of Jordan or the king of Saudi Arabia is starting to repeat that rhetoric, that's problematic, correct?
Mm.
The whole idea about like we need to kill the infidels, and if the president of Egypt started saying that, that's problematic. Now, if the prime minister is not just that, the members of his cabinet. I mean, we just talked about the example about like insulting Christians.
Yeah.
Bin Ghafir, he's the minister of national security of Israel. The guy said like spitting on Christians is not a hate crime; it's part of my faith. That is a minister.
Mm.
So I'm not picking on because you can pick on extreme people on the internet from the Muslim side, from the Christian side, from the Jewish side. But I'm talking about people who are in position of power.
Yeah, no, I know.
I'm not just like picking random people from the thing, because and also all of these people that you might think it's fringe or controversial, it is not. There is a movie that I highly recommend. It's a documentary. It's a two-part. It's on YouTube. It's called Praying for Armageddon. I really urge everybody, especially Americans, to watch it, because they're talking about how the ideology of the Armageddon and the second coming of Jesus has been a huge part of American politics. I mean, you see the reporter asking people from the Congress, like Laura Boebert, which is like a right winger. She's from Colorado, and she said he asked her about the rapture and the second coming. She's like, I believe that there are two nations in this planet and this world that were created to honor the glory of God. One, they are the United States of America and Israel. I'm gonna work for both. I'm gonna be loyal for both. And then you have asking other people, it's like, don't you think that this is the whole thing about second coming of Jesus and rapture is extreme? He said, no, I don't think it is extreme. When Jesus comes, I'll be here waiting for you, for him. So, and here's the problem. You have American politicians supporting Israel for that religious promise of apocalypse.
Mm.
And they believe that they did that, it's going to be like a 7 years of tribulation, it's going to be the end of war. And when that happens, the second Jesus will come. And on the other side, the Jews believe the same thing. But the outcome is different, because the Christians believe that all Jews will either be killed or converted. And the Jews believe that the one who's coming is not the second coming of Jesus. It's going to be the real Jesus, the real Messiah. And everybody will be enslaved by the Jews. You understand how stupid this is?
Not great outcomes, yeah.
You know how stupid it is? And now they're openly talking about the red heifers. They brought like 5 cows from Texas. They paid $500,000 to fly them for Texas. That is more than all the money that I've ever spent on my life on plane ticket. They flew cows from Texas. And now they are going to turn 3 years old by the 10th of April. And they are going to have a ceremony by killing them, having a blood sacrifice, burning the bodies of the cows, and having Jewish people bathe into the water so they're going to be purified. So it's going to be a way to go to like a step to, in order to build the third temple over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is, you understand, the people who control the world are religious fanatics. Mm-hmm. And I come from a place that where I was told, like, your religion is dangerous. Your religion is apocalyptic. No, Islam is bad. Mm-hmm. Come join our secular ranks. And I come, it's like, what the hell is this? You guys are even crazier. At least the people who talk about the end of days in Islam don't have nuclear weapons like you. At least the people who are back home are just like, you know, all that they have, like maybe a little like primitive bombs. Mm. But you have like the biggest nuclear arsenal and you're pushing for Armageddon right in front of everybody. And what is this? You understand? You understand my confusion?
I understand.
I came from the Middle East, secularism, separation of church and state. Yeah. And then suddenly it's like, but you are going to be killed because you are on the wrong side of history and Jesus is going to kill you. It's like, what the hell?
You're preaching to the converted man. I'm an atheist. I'm not here.
But you understand how crazy
this is? Yeah, I do, I do. What do you think the point of difference is, right, in the States, comparing the States and Britain, right? I think in America, there's much more of a political consensus, particularly when it comes to Israel, right? Particularly when it comes to Israel, the things you've just outlined and that evangelical tradition. And in the UK, whilst there is, particularly in the political class and the media class, that alignment, there is, I would say, a more divergent strand of thought, particularly within the political left, that is willing to be critical of Israel in a way that the American left perhaps isn't. Is that just down to evangelicalism? Is there something different happening politically in America?
Well, you know, 80 million people in America are evangelists. That's a quarter of the population. So that's a huge mass.
Yeah.
And you know what is scary and crazy about it is that the Bible that they follow is the Scofield interpretation of the King James Bible. The Scofield interpretation was published in the 19th century by a university press, Oxford University Press. And it has footnotes that interprets the text in a different way, and that's quite manipulated in order to kind of flip the narrative towards Israel. And there's a very famous joke. They say the Christian Bible is read from left to right. The Hebrew Bible is read from right to left. The Scofield Bible is read from bottom up because the notes, the footnotes controlled everything. So that actually found a huge, it resonated with the evangelicals in the South Baptist Church. And this is like a, you know, people like, you know, Jerry Falwell, John Hagee. John Hagee, he is the founder of Christian United for Christ. They have a $7 billion budget to influence the candidates in the Congress. John Hagee gave $80 million from his own money, not his own money, because this is Congress, people in his congregation, to Israel. And you find all of this. So part of it is A, religion. Huge part of it is money, because many of the Democrats are not even evangelical, but you have now AIPAC on their Twitter account bragging about all of their candidates that we have supported have won their primaries. So, isn't that a foreign agent? What is this? Yeah, I mean, remember 2016 when everybody said, oh my God, Russia is interfering and tampering, cybersecurity is tampering. And then you have like, you have AIPAC just open. It's like, yeah, if you support Israel, you're going to win the election with our money. I was like, what? What is this? And people just like looking at that, like, okay, that's fine. I was like, what I'm seeing is madness.
Mm.
You understand? And people are just like, yeah, okay, it's normal. And whether in Britain, I mean, I don't understand much of British politics. I cannot really understand the effect. Nobody. But like, there's one thing that happened in the beginning of the war where Rishi Sunak, the prime minister, when he went to Israel, he stayed in the King David Hotel. The King David Hotel, which was bombed by the Stern gang, a Zionist gang, mm-hmm. killing 91 or 92 British soldiers. And it, you know, Israel doesn't do anything by chance. This is a humiliation. And if I was a British citizen, like, how come my prime minister goes in and stay in that hotel that where 92 British soldiers were killed by Zionists? Gangs, and because of that, people like Isaac Shamir and all of those people weren't even allowed into London because they were on the terrorist list for many years until he became a prime minister, so he had diplomatic immunity. So you look at all of this, it's like, why do you accept that? How do you accept all of that? I mean, how do you live with that? It's just, as an outsider, I come and I say, is this for real? Am I the only one seeing this? Am I stupid? Or maybe I'm anti-Semitic and I don't know.
That's what I was talking to you about, like what terrorism means, right? Because on the plaque outside the King David Hotel, it says something like, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, you know, the brave freedom fighters of the Stern Gang, you know, took action against the British military.
Oh my God.
And it's like, you know.
And Rishi Sunak stayed in that hotel.
But, well, yeah, and then in
I
the
hope
UK,
you're happy, Rishi. I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy, motherfucker.
Is it cuck? Is that the term? I don't know.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's the Politics Show cast.
But interestingly, the politics here has kind of changed a little bit, like it's shifting in Britain. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, but you know, particularly on the left wing in the Labour Party, we've gone from October 7th happens, and you get the bizarre sight of Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, basically saying that collective punishment is acceptable. And he used to be a human rights lawyer, right? So he should know better than that.
Yeah.
And gradually, he's sort of been pulled, I think, as a result of electoral politics, softening his stance to now demanding a humanitarian ceasefire. But for me, I'm sort of looking at it thinking, well, what's the point of difference to what you said earlier? It's like, okay, how many people have to die? Choose your number. Where is it that you say, okay, enough is enough now. We've gone too far. I'm changing my position. Because once it started, I feel like anyone with any basic grasp of the history knew what was going to happen. It was going to be a bloodbath, right? It was going to be a massacre.
But nobody even imagined that would be that big. But you know what's really sad about it, Joe? What's really sad about it? If today Israel decides to stop their military actions and say, all right, we'll leave you, we're good, no more killing, people will applaud Netanyahu. But good, it's good that you didn't kill more people. Thank you for not killing 60,000. Thank you for stopping at 33. You see, there's not going to be even accountability for Israel.
Mm.
If they stop this, I'm like, okay, good. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for giving people the disabled and the people who killed some food. Thank you so much, Israel. You don't understand? You understand that we have seen the biggest human crime right unfold in front of our eyes for 6 months. And Israel will walk away from it. No accountability. There's going to be no consequence for it whatsoever. Then they're even getting more arms, getting more aid, getting more money, getting more support of the Western world. Even being applauded for killing not so much civilians. See how, you see, it's just, people are just like, our scream is like, stop the killing. That is the minimum that you can ask as human beings. And when it finally happens, whatever happens in the last 6 months, whether in the West Bank, or East of Jerusalem, or Gaza, will just go unpunished. What kind of message are we telling our children?
Mm.
That as long as you have the power, the weapons, the support of the Western world, the support of America, you can do whatever you want, and you will be even applauded by stopping short at a total annihilation. That is the message, basically, we're telling to our children. What kind of values are you instilling to today's generation? I think it's not going to end one for anybody.
No. Interesting phrase you use there, right, which is Western support for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often we hear here in the UK, well, what does it matter if our political position changes, if we withdraw our support for Israel? What difference will it make? As if that kind of ignores the fact that we grant export licenses for weapons that go to Israel and then get used in Gaza. And I kind of wonder what you make of those arguments that international pressure can't change the facts of what's happening there.
Why don't we withdraw our support to Ukraine?
Yeah.
If it doesn't make any difference, then. It's just...
it doesn't bear engaging.
And the fact that you have like an evil player in the world just like violating all the international laws and getting away with it, what kind of message are you giving to the rest of the world? How can you have a moral standing if anybody else commits war crimes if you're letting this happen? You can't. I mean, the thing is, I said it before, I said Israel has corrupted the West morally for 100 years. You cannot come with a straight face lecturing us about morality or about human rights anymore. You can't. You can't just go cry about... Do you remember Charlie Hebdo? 11 people were killed. Terrible. The world leaders collected into the streets of France. It's like, oh, Charlie Hebdo. And we changed our profile. You sweetheart, Charlie. 11 people. Oh, my God. 30,000 people. Ah, they're collateral damage. Inevitable. It's sad. It's sad. It's just like, and you watch these like TV anchors. Oh, yeah, there's too much civilians. It's sad, but it has to happen. I mean, what can we do? Not this.
Yeah. anything but this.
What else can we do? It's very frustrating to look at this, and just it is comical, but it's painful.
Okay, let's talk about that, because you talk about frustration, you've talked about how sad it is. I agree with both of those things. I'm also conscious of the fact that you've made me laugh multiple times over the course of this conversation, which, and not in like a rude way, like you're being funny. And
no, please do. I'm a comedian. My ego feeds on you laughing.
Stroking your ego.
Yeah, please.
Yeah,
please,
yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Please.
You're so amazing, Bassem.
Please,
yeah,
I'm full of insecurities. And I have delayed payment on my ego.
Can you tell me more about the tension between those two things? About sort of subject matter that perhaps even some people would say you shouldn't make jokes about that. We shouldn't laugh about that. It's so serious. Mm. It's so upsetting that there is no humor. There is nowhere to laugh in there.
Well, sometimes it's very difficult to, but like, I didn't even attempt to make any jokes. What I did was just repeating the talking points, like, yeah, impersonating. It was like, oh, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, please go ahead. I killed Paul. I was just like impersonating. I was just like speaking my mind of how I view these people. And it comes up comical because it is nonsense.
Yeah.
It's nonsensical, you know. And the thing is, I said before, they make you get so used to cruelty, you don't even know how to keep up. Like, I'll give you an example. Remember how Donald Trump was so difficult to make fun of?
Yeah.
Because by the time you catch up with one of his like atrocious statements, he's already on the second one. He said stuff like, oh, you can I grab them by the pussies. And everybody, oh my God, grab them by the pussies. And then like 2 weeks later, I can go into Fifth Avenue and kill someone and shoot someone in the face. It's like, oh my God. And then he moved. So it became normal. This is what Israel is doing. It's just like, it's upping the cruelty. And just by the time you're now 6 months, you don't even talk about children starved to death or people killing each other for flour. Or babies dying because there's no electricity in the incubators. We don't even speak about that because we forgot. Just like, it's become so normal. We don't talk about the little people that were like mutilated and killed. We don't even talk about sexual violence against Palestinians. We don't talk about that because it became so more normal. Just because it's are you still talking about that? Are you still talking about the incubators? We have passed that. We now killing them in front of you on cameras, and we will deny it. And you're not going to be able to do anything about it. And if you speak about it, you're an anti-Semite. You see? Mm. You see how it is so stupid?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, it is very depressing.
Yeah.
And yet it's mind-blowing. And this is I think the frustration that comes with like the people who are on television media, because the people in the streets that goes out every weekend, they see these things. And the reason why they escalate the anger and they escalate the frustration is they see people in the media and on the political level, they don't speak about that at all, as if it doesn't happen. So now, at a certain point, these protests will be more intense. It's like, oh, look at them, barbaric.
Hate marches, yeah.
Anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
You push them to that, and it's like, oh, look at the reaction that I have just made them do. You see?
Yeah.
You see how it is? This is that I've been doing. I mean, I gave you an example. A synagogue in Toronto was hosting an event, a real estate event, to sell land and houses in the West Bank, illegal settlements, which is violating all kinds of laws, and you can only buy it if you're Jewish, which is another discriminatory law. So people went and they marched, they had a demonstration against this in front of the synagogue. And you know what the pro-Israelis like? Oh, look at the anti-Semites. They are there in front of our synagogue. Oh, Holocaust. Oh, anti-Semite. Oh, please. And they forgot. And they don't talk about what led to that. You see?
Mm.
It's just like it's about your reaction. Oh, they're angry Arabs, terrorists. They want to kill us. You see, that it's been going on for 6 months and people falling for it every time.
But I think that's quite dangerous politically, right? The thing you're talking about there where everyone can see the reality of what's happening in the ground. It's almost a phenomenon that's associated with social media, right? There's no longer a filter. There's no longer a control of the information. You can just see the video, right? You see what's happening.
People didn't know about the Holocaust until years after it. But you're seeing the Holocaust right live.
You're watching it happen, right?
And people don't care.
And there's a disconnect, right, between the reality that you can see here and then the actual discourse, the conversation, whether it's in political class, media class, large parts of culture. And that disconnect is a very politically dangerous thing, right? Because all of a sudden you have this huge group of people who are very angry and go, why aren't you fucking talking about the thing that I can see with my own eyes? Are you not morally outraged? Mm-hmm. Is this not a problem?
Mm-hmm.
So one, I think it's politically dangerous. But two, I wonder if that changes how you feel as someone of cultural significance, that almost that responsibility then almost forces you into participating in discourse, raising awareness, challenging people publicly in a way that perhaps you'd expect a more political figure, or not say that you're not an intellectual, but like a public intellectual, you're almost entering this arena because of the complete absence. It's like a vacuum, right? The people that should be talking about it aren't.
Yeah, well, I think that's why people, I mean, it happened to me before in Egypt. I was a comedian talking about stuff but on people's mind, and I just happened to hit a nerve, and I'm doing the same thing. When people ask me, why do you think it went viral, the Piers Morgan thing, it's like, because I was speaking the stuff that people are saying every single day. I'm not that smart, by the way. I'm just like repeating what people are saying everywhere else, and you're not giving them any kind of attention.
Mm.
So it went viral. It's like, oh, this is exactly what we're saying. And you want to, they feel connected, they feel that what they say that is resonated, so that's why it goes viral. And but the thing is, it is not that difficult. It is right there in front of your eyes, and it just, as you said, the disconnect is harrowing. It's very difficult. It's scary.
It's really scary. It's really scary. Last couple of questions before I let you go.
I'm enjoying this.
I'm enjoying it as well. It's great, actually. okay, so
I mean, I'll give you an example about the disconnect. You had the Western media running with decapitated babies and gang rape and whatever, and even the Israeli media refuted these allegations. There were no decapitated babies, all of that, the story about like cutting people's out of their babies out of their wombs, all of that was refuted. And they talk openly about the Zaka and the Hatzolah United, how they squandered people for millions of dollars for these lies that was repeated by Secretary Antony Blinken. That didn't happen. I mean, the Antony Blinken death testimony in front of Congress, do you remember? It's like, the father has his eyes gouged, the mother had his breast chopped off, she was raped, the little girl had her limb amputated, and the other kid was having his finger amputated, and then they did all of that, and they sat down having dinner, having breakfast and laughing. I said, where's the IDF? Where are the planes that were hitting the kibbutz? Where? Are we stupid? Are we fucking stupid? You expect to say this story in front of Congress? And the IDF will proudly brag about like a response time of 3 minutes. Where's their F-16s and the Apaches and their tanks? And they were actively shooting. They're just like sitting there having breakfast after like comfortably owning all of this, including cutting off someone's limbs and raping another one. What kind of this? Jake Tapper on CNN, he went and he said, he went with every single sob story, allegation of rape, allegation of decapitated babies. He went with every single one of them. And he did not refute any one of them. None of these Western media outlets even bothered to translate the Israeli media. And I said, like me, an Arab, a Middle Eastern, I'm using Israeli media to prove my point. You see how stupid this is?
Mm.
See how crazy this is? None of them. It's just like, guys, we messed up. We went too hot with this. We apologize because these stories were used in order to make people accept the killing of so many Palestinians. We are part of this. We are sorry. None of them did it. And I even say, like, you know, Jake Tapper, like, he's a great journalist. I don't mean to say that he sucks, but he does. But, like, Jake Tapper, he has a great new show on CNN called United Scandals of America. And I think he should include his own coverage in that show because that's a scandal that he did. So, yeah, that is the Western media. Such a disappointment.
Yeah, for sure. And I wonder, I'm not going to obviously ask you for, like, how do we bring peace to the Middle East? Because I think
that's not my problem. Yeah, you guys mess it up. You don't come to a comedian after 75 years
and tell me, like, perhaps,
I don't care.
Yeah.
You guys mess up. I don't have any solutions, but all I can tell you is whatever is happening in the media right now is ridiculous.
Stupid.
And it's stupid and it has to stop. And it's an insult to everybody's intelligence.
Do you think then, okay, so do you think it's as simple as this, that there's a problem with it, like, general intelligence? You keep saying stupid, right? Is it just that the people who work in the industry aren't smart enough to realize
the reality
of what's going on?
They know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing.
That's
different. They know exactly what they're doing. They know what Israel is doing is wrong, and they're covering for it. Why? I don't know. I'm not going to give any. I have no idea. But what is happening right now, and this, like, scandalous covering, the coverage of the news, is violates every single lesson that they gave us about the news and about transparency. When you have the New York Times being the mouthpiece, remember 2003, when the New York Times were the mouthpiece of the Bush administration about the WMDs, where never found.
We had the same here in the UK. Yeah.
And I said, like, you know what? Fine, I'm an Arab. I'm used to having a news publication being the mouthpiece of a president. You know, it's like, it's nostalgic. I understand that. I understand that. But 20 years later, the New York Times become the mouthpiece of a foreign government of Israel. Like, you know, they actually, like, they push all of these, like, crazy stories. They just repeat the rape allegations. Like, give the story for, like, an Israeli IDF spokesman and her nephew. And they have all of these, like, alleged non-verified stories. And when even the Daily, which is the New York Times podcast, even when they pulled back, They doubled down, and they did what Nixon did when the New York Times exposed him before about, like, the stuff that was okay. There is a story. There's a context here. So New York Times, beginning of 1970s, they published a piece about Nixon using lies to justify the Vietnam War. So Nixon went crazy and he launched an investigation to know who leaked it, and that led to Watergate. And then when that happened in the Daily, the New York Times, instead of actually apologizing for the lies, they said they launched an internal investigation to see who leaked the facts about how this was a botched story. You understand how it is? So I can accept, as a Middle Eastern, you being the mouthpiece of a president, but you being a mouthpiece of a client state, a state that we fund from our own taxpayers' money, that's an insult. That is just like a very low way to descend. And the New York Times, the beacon of Western media.
I'm conscious that we've spoken a lot about the media in this, which is fine, but I'm seeing, on the one hand, right, okay, so we can't send our reporters into Gaza, they're being denied access, right? And on the other hand, we've got the information that's coming straight from the IDF, and anyone who knows anything, which these international reporters do, by the way, you know, they understand war to a pretty serious extent. They understand that there's also an information war as well as a practical war, right? That who controls the airwaves, that's relevant. Who can put out information, it's useful, right? It's the reason why sort of the video cameras on the drones in Ukraine and Russia has been so useful, because you get to see all this video distributed on Telegram and on Twitter, and it can change people's opinions about a war, right? So if you understand that that's the fact, and the IDF are not letting you go into Gaza, surely you say, well, okay, well, we're not going to just reprint your news releases until you send us in there. We're not going to, the information you're giving us, we can't verify it. It's not true.
Yeah. Or at least how about having a bit of common sense? Like, for when the New York Times publishes, like, a hit piece, just, like, repeating the talking point of the IDF, saying there's actually about 450 miles of Hamas tunnels inside. 450 miles of tunnels? You know that the New York subway system, in the richest country of the world, in the richest state of America, is 400 It's 7 miles less than that. 7 miles less than that. You want me to believe that, like, in a small strip of land, Gaza, Hamas built that? I mean, you should hire those people to fix your infrastructure. Seriously. I mean, what kind of a feat that the Hamas people would have 450 miles of tunnels underneath Gaza? You don't need anything more than common sense to say that this is bullshit. You don't need reporters to report from inside to say this bullshit. You have Israel, which is like a regime that has been caught lying many times. Remember Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian American reporter that was killed for a whole year? They denied. It's like, oh, and then they even released doctored videos of Islamic Jihad killing it. And then it's like, oh, okay, it was us. Sorry. It's just they lie. They lie consistently and they don't care. And if you catch them lying, it's like, well, we're defending ourselves.
Yeah, very dangerous for the journalist with a camera. Let's talk about calling things bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
Saying that's bullshit, that's a lie. Standing up and speaking out, which I appreciate in the context of a war, is not necessarily, you know, the most dangerous thing in the world. But it is nonetheless brave, particularly in the context of a media environment, which we've just been talking about, which at times is particularly uncritical when it comes to this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever concerned about sort of speaking out about this in the way that you have done, particularly actually for your American audience, which I know it's different here in the UK, a little bit different, but certainly in America where speaking out against Israel, it can be career suicide for people, right?
At times. Yeah. And I had a little bit of pushback and I lost a couple of jobs in Hollywood, but you know, but I always say, like, I'm lucky that I'm in stand-up comedy, that there's no middleman between me and the audience.
Yeah.
So maybe I've been dropped by the establishment, but I have been chosen by the people. Ha! Ha! Did you see that? You see how cheesy this was?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cool. Like, I was dropped by the establishment, but I was chosen by
the
people.
Yeah. And you should open with that when you start.
Yeah,
in
I should open there. And I don't know. I mean, as you said, like, there's no middleman between you and the audience. People come and pay the ticket and come to see you doing live audience. I'm not under the mercy of some executive producer in Hollywood waiting for me to give a role. You know, or there. So it's fine.
Do it yourself.
And I don't even think I'm a good actor. I think I suck. So maybe I've done Hollywood a solid.
Possibly for the best. Yeah, then, yeah,
maybe
that you're not getting booked for those jobs. That
the cameras never see me.
When people see you performing live, and we'll wrap this up in a second. What can they?
You're coming to my shows, right?
Do you want me to?
Yeah. Do we have tickets for Joe? Yeah, baby.
I guess I'll come. See? There we go. Mm-hmm. I endorse this man. What can people expect when they see you? Is it political? What are you going to talk about?
It is political, but it doesn't have to do anything with the current events. Because this is, as you know, in stand-up comedy, you work on your special. And I have been working on my special for 5 years, and this is my first special. So it's political, but it's my personal story. It's like me moving, being a doctor, becoming a TV host in a comedy, being interrogated for my jokes, and then finding myself in America under Trump, and then finding myself in a Trump rally, or in the middle of a bombing, or by me trying to get the American citizenship. So it's all about personal stories that is relatable to anybody. Even if you are Arab, or if you're white, if you're British, or American, it's a very international, global story that I think brings people together. And I want people to come, not as I don't want this to be a political statement for what's happening, because I don't think I'm ready to talk about what's happening right now. But I think it's good to have to get people and share a moment of laughter, even about some uncomfortable truth about us being different and having to have all of these kind of expectations against us.
Awesome, Yusuf. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.